Enterprise Linux Security is brought to you by TuxCare, a company that helps you modernize your Linux security. Definitely check out TuxCare to see how they can help you automate Linux patching while minimizing downtime, staying compliant, and ensuring business continuity. Check them out at TuxCare.com. Hello and welcome back to Enterprise Linux Security, this time episode 106. I'm here as always with my good friend Zhao. How you doing?
Hello, good Jay. As always, a pleasure being here with you. And yeah, it's facepalm day again. So if you have your bingo card ready, get it out because you're going to have some opportunities to score today.
Yeah, I would say so. And facepalm and company decisions, some of the big companies out there kind of seem to go hand in hand lately. But we'll get to that because we need to talk about FIDO. And what we'll be getting to is FIDO, obviously. That's the title. And it's a great technology. I'm not going to bash it too much. But the problem is when corporations get a hold of it, things generally don't go the way we want them to go. So a good solution is kind of turning out to be a little hard to implement, but we'll get to that. But first, I believe we have some vulnerabilities and CVE shenanigans to get through.
Yeah. So this is the public service announcement for today. Yesterday, there were six new CVEs for rsync that were disclosed. Four of them are for daemon mode, two are for regular rsync operation. There's already some updates available on multiple distros. If you see updates for it, you should do it as soon as possible. Keep in mind that this was a coordinated disclosure, so there might be some more behind it than they're letting out. The reason why this is important is that lots of tools use rsync on the back end and you're not even aware of it. And it's also a part of many CI/CD pipelines, so you're likely using rsync even if you don't recall having explicitly used it in any script or something like that. So make sure that you get it updated as soon as you can.
Yeah, I use rsync like almost every other day. It's one of the most used tools. And I would say probably a staggering number of people in our audience use it probably almost daily, especially if you think of the MSP space when you're doing lift and shifts. That's like the tried and true method of, you know, people use it for backing up their servers. It's insane. So update it.
A bit more detail about the vulnerability now that you're bringing it up. The important stuff is around the way rsync uses symbolic links. Apparently, for one of the vulnerabilities, there is a check, and rsync by default will ignore the links, but apparently it's possible to trick it into following links into places where it shouldn't. Because there's a place in the code where it makes a check to see if the file that it's going to copy is a link or not, and if it's a link, it skips it. But it's possible to actually erase the rsync execution and have it check a file and then immediately replace the file with the link, and it will follow the link. That's one of the vulnerabilities. So yeah, it's nasty stuff out there. But talking about CVEs, there's another topic that I usually bring to the podcast, and I've ranted about this previously, and so please bear with me. Earlier today, I was looking at the vulnerability numbers for previous years. For the past 4 or 5 years, we're working on the 2024 end of year report, and we needed some numbers. So I was looking at the vulnerability numbers. And I came across this, to me, incredible number, which is, at the time that we're recording this, it's January 15. And bear with me, I had written this 3 hours ago, and it's already out of date. I had written that there were already 100 disclosed CVEs on just 2 weeks. I double-checked 5 minutes ago, it's up to 134. There were 34 new CVEs disclosed for the kernel alone. We're up to 134 kernel CVEs disclosed in just these past 2 weeks. To put this into perspective, in 2020, the entire year, there were 120. Okay, so 2 weeks, we already have more CVEs for the kernel than in 2020, the entire year. On the past 5 years, excluding 2024, the year where with the highest number of CVEs was 2022. It had 309. It was a particularly bad year for the kernel security. In 2024, last year, after the kernel CNA started to operating, the kernel CVE numbering authority, there were 3,529. Okay, this is just the kernel. This is not user space, this is not libraries, this is not nothing else. These are just CVEs that directly touch the kernel. 10 CVEs per day, every single day for the entire year, just for the kernel. when you have in mind that there are places with policies that says you can't run production with non-patched CVEs, or you have X amount of days to patch any new non-CVE, then you can see why this is really, really a problem. There are a lot of exceptions being added to compliance reports right now, and this doesn't seem to be slowing down anytime soon.
Yeah, it's crazy because at some point there's going to be uncomfortable conversations where system administrators all over the globe are trying to explain to their boss, you know, why they can't keep up with the CVEs, or perhaps why they can't be patched the same way they've been. It's creating a toxic environment for system administrators to try to navigate. It's insane. Like, the number of CVEs is just staggering.
It's the kernel CNA policy. They initially came out with every single bug gets a CVE. Sure, they're refusing a very tiny percentage, but when you follow the number of bugs on the kernel, it's massive. Every single day there are new bugs there that are disclosed. If you assign a CVE for every single one, then this is the end result. And this is somewhat similar when you have that situation where somebody comes up to you with a problem. You need to fix this problem right now. It's urgent. And then 5 minutes later, somebody else comes along. I have this amazing problem. It needs to be fixed right now. It's urgent. And then somebody else. Oh, I have a problem and my issue is very important. You need to solve it. It's urgent. If everybody's problem is urgent, then none of them is urgent. So you'll just do it whenever you want to do it. When you get so many CVEs, you won't be able to look at each of them and see if there's anything special about any particular one. So you might miss out on some important stuff that comes through in the pipeline because you're just dealing with so many of them. And then, again, it's impossible to do this manually. You either need to rely on automatic tools or automation or live patching like we do at TuxCare, but trying to cope with the amazing number of vulnerabilities that we've been having since the kernel CNA started to operate, it's humanly impossible. It's a problem for the distros, it's a problem for the end users, it's a problem for organizations that fall out of compliance, because it's impossible to be in compliance when every single day you have dozens of vulnerabilities. The kernel team does a fantastic job. These guys are wizards with the code that they create. They are incredibly creative people. They have amazing attention to detail. But they're not judging the situation accurately right now. I am going to continue to believe that this is not malicious compliance. There's a sentence by Greg Rohartman a few years ago, in 2019, in a presentation he did, where he claimed that the CVE system was so bad that it should be burned to the ground. I'm not believing that this is the intention. I'm not believing that this is malicious compliance. They're honestly trying to do something good here. They're just not properly assessing the result for everybody else and the problems that come from this. This is not sustainable in the long run. This is not sustainable in the midterm anyway. So this is a problem. This just keeps snowballing. And this year it's on track to even have more vulnerabilities than last year, if that's even possible. They're going to burn the CV process right down to the ground if this continues.
It's already starting. No one can keep up with that, like you mentioned, and system administrators are just busy enough as it is, and then trying to explain to CTOs that might not understand technology as much as we do, what's going on here with all these vulnerabilities, and perhaps some companies will start throwing people at the problem to try to keep up with it. If they don't go the automated route, it's going to be costly, and it's going to cost burnout, I think, too, especially for people working in security right now. Their jobs aren't getting any easier.
Most of the CVEs are crap, are stuff that is not even applicable to what you're using, or it's just on some corner case that will never be reached, but it still gets a CVE. The compliance people, they don't care if it's a corner case or not. All they see is a CVE and it's unpatched. So you need to address it or you fall out of compliance. This is a problem for large companies. This is a problem for anybody doing business in any fashion with the government or with anybody else that in turn is doing business with government agencies in the US, because they need to meet compliance requirements. There's compliance requirements elsewhere. This isn't just a US problem. This has bigger ramifications than you can see just by looking at the numbers. again, this is not sustainable in the long run.
Yeah, and we're definitely going to be following this continually as this develops, because, you know, we definitely need something done about this, and it's, you know, just hard to keep up in the meantime while, you know, all this is happening. But we'll be here reporting it as it develops, and we'll see what comes out of it. Hopefully something good.
Let's see about that.
Yeah. Trying to be optimistic. It's, you know, nobody wants to hear that they have more to do or whatever it is, but the certification programs themselves, I think this is part of the bigger part of the problem, is that the right thing to do is to adjust the qualifying process, or maybe adjust the things that are considered for fix or urgency. But these programs don't update often. I mean, it's kind of like, it could take years for a certification program to release a new version. You think of SOC 2 and all these other things, and they have their requirements. They don't update all the time. I mean, yeah, they might be making modifications, but generally I would think if they're going to adjust that, then it's going to be considered more lax, then the certification might not be considered as good. And then meanwhile, you have system administrators trying to keep up with it. So yeah, again, I guess we'll see how it goes.
Again, I really don't want to go over the problems that this causes, but there's so many CVs, and this blows my mind. There's so many CVs out there that it's even impossible to score them accurately. Most of them are being disclosed without a risk score associated. The kernel CNA team says that it's not their job to assign scores, and be that as it may, it might not be their job, but there are so many CVEs that it's impossible for anybody else to assign them a score. So what ends up happening is that you're having vulnerabilities out in the open for everybody to know about them without a score associated. When you don't get a score, you can't do prioritization. So you either patch everything, so you will have your systems down for patching every single day, or you use an alternative solution like live patching, but you need to do something, or you'll fall out of compliance. Again, if your organization isn't too concerned about compliance, you might not realize the problem that this entails, but this can mean the end of a business. If you fall out of compliance in finance or something like that, you're forbidden from doing business, you're forbidden from trading, you're forbidden from acquiring assets. You need to be in compliance, and it's impossible to follow it if you cannot patch at this rate. So, yeah. We better go rant about FIDO in the meantime.
Or else. We better rant about FIDO, because I could tell by the look on your face that, you know, you want so desperately to just rant about this. So you're going to sip your drink and be nonchalant about it. But me too. I mean, this is, it's just upsetting when, especially, you know, you have things like this. But the last thing I'll say is that the irony is that there's no one better to understand the severity of a bug than the people that are actually writing the code. So it's interesting to me, like, obviously that, you know, they're not the only ones that are good at writing code, but it's, if there's anyone that's the best person to score something, I wonder if it's someone who knows the code enough to know the domino effect of, yeah, there's this vulnerability, but it interacts with this and it interacts with that and this. And opinions can be different from, you know, depending on who's looking. But yeah, let's rant about FIDO, because we could also rant about passwords, which I'm going to do a little bit about that now. This is the ranting episode, I guess. But,
we,
you know, as
we,
I mentioned,
should get, we should, yeah, get Statler and Waldorf icon for the podcast, the two grouchy guys from the Muppets.
Yeah, maybe we should have a Things That Grind Our Gears episode. No, but I, as I wrote in the description, two things that I know universally most, if not all of us, hate are, you know, passwords, DNS, add printers to that too, because, you know, that's a trifecta of hate when it comes to being a system administrator. And I came across this article from Ars Technica that's linked in the description, and it brought up some really interesting points and concerns, valid concerns in my opinion, that I wanted to talk about. Now, obviously, to backtrack a little bit, we need to talk about passwords, and I'll keep this super short because I'm sure no one wants to hear this, but just to kind of set the, you know, the realm, passwords have been in existence forever, and obviously the easiest way to use a password, just like the article said, is just use the same password on everything. But that's the worst thing to do, because that's how you get everything owned. So the only way forward is to have a different password on, you know, every site, And then that's not good enough. They need to be longer. They need to be a bunch of gobbledygook that nobody can remember. So now enter password managers. And for us, this is all pretty simple. I mean, we just deal with it. We use whatever our password manager of choice is. But as the article mentions, you know, you think about your uncle or a family member, somebody who's not into technology trying to navigate this. Passwords were hard enough, and we still haven't got to the point where the average person uses a password manager. Unless they're a power user or they understand technology better than most. Most family members in your family probably aren't using a password manager, but we've been trying to get that to catch on. But it just kind of, I mean, the problem is passwords suck. No matter what you put around it, the app you use with it, however you manage it, and I'm sure many people in the audience have a great way of managing their passwords, and they're probably really responsible, but it's still something that they have to do. So now we get into passkeys. FIDO technology, you know, it's a private or public-private key pair. So if you use SSH, it's not dissimilar to that. The idea is to have a universal login mechanism where there's no password anymore. You have one half of the key, the site has the other. And obviously, I'm super simplifying it here. But the idea being we could finally get rid of passwords. And this is a technology that, passkey technology, that kind of seems to be, you know, it's not taking off, but it's gaining traction. A lot of sites that I frequent are offering to allow you to use passkeys now. So we know the technology is happening. But it's still not gaining mass adoption. Now, when we think about that, we could think about some of the reasons why that's the case. Now, before we get to the main point of the article that it brings up, passkeys aren't really simple by default. I mean, they can be, but a problem is you could have a passkey stored on your phone, but it's not on your, you know, Windows computer, Linux computer, whatever. So now you have a site you can only log into from one device. If you could sync your passkeys between devices, that kind of fixes that, because now your, you know, laptop has the same passkeys as your phone has, so that's a little bit better. But we start to get into vendor lock-in, and that's when I feel like all of this just comes tumbling down.
Yeah, it's the walled garden for passkeys. Apple, it's that meme from Harry Potter where the teacher calls Harry and Hermione and Ron, and whenever there's a problem, it's always you three. And right now it's Google, Apple, and Microsoft. Each one has their own implementations on how to store the passkeys. They'll very happily share the passkeys within their own ecosystem, but by God, don't let that passkey move to somebody else. Somebody else's infrastructure or will be in problem. We'll have a problem. Yep. So the real hassle here is not registering the passkeys or creating them. It's how you're locked to the device or to the OS or to the browser where you created that passkey. As you were saying, if you created on your desktop and now you want to access that website on your phone, you need to sync the passkey over, and the mechanism isn't that reliable. macOS doesn't let you sync your passkey with your iPhone, which is ridiculous for some reason. But again, it's the walled garden approach all over again. It's not just for apps, it's also for security.
Right. And it seems like the problem is getting worse. At first, I thought it was just me because I'm using it, and I put in my hardware key and I go to log in, and it gives me two choices in my browser right there at the front, either A or B. You know, A, you know, use their proprietary solution, or B, I'm just going to use my passkey. And that was pretty easy because all I had to do was click one time and that's it. I just clicked that one link right there. I want to use my passkey. I didn't even have to go to a sub menu or anything. And then it comes up and I do it. But then after some time passed, I kind of noticed that the passkey option gets harder to find. It gets, now it's under a sub menu. And the first thing that comes up is, you know, the proprietary technology, but then I have to go to a sub menu to get to the passkey. So, okay, that sucks, but I know how to do it and I can get through it. And then, you know, time passes again, and then it starts to get even stranger. Then it's the dialog box looks more like the operating system, and it doesn't make it clear that it's, you know, Google or whoever it is, that it's a proprietary technology. And then I started getting to a point where I almost created an account or a passkey, another one, on those sites And I stopped myself right at the end because it seems to me like these implementations are increasingly trying to circumvent the user experience to try to get people into their platform. So then a week or so ago, I found this article, the one that's linked in the description from Ars Technica, that really goes into detail about the issues around this. And when I read it, I knew right then and there, okay, it's not all in my head. This is really happening. This is really getting harder and harder to navigate. And there's interesting things that the article brings up, and some of which just kind of make it out to be that passkeys may not be the technology we were hoping, or at least its implementation is killing it. And when we start to get into the vendor lock-in, like what I've experienced, and then I start reading what the author of this article also experienced that meshed well with my worldview, then I realized that if something isn't done about this, it's just going to be so hard to implement and so confusing. I mean, passwords are confusing for people. Let's remember that. Okay, a simple username and password can be confusing for people. And now we have to explain at a family dinner what a passkey is and why it's different on someone's Android phone versus their iPhone. It's just weird. And the oddest part is that do these companies just not realize that they're shooting themselves in the foot? It doesn't seem like it.
The problem is not so much the passkey itself, as somebody was mentioning on the chat. It's that the vendor lock-in causes this to be so difficult to use for the regular user. It's not for the power users. It's not for the tech-savvy people. It's not for the ones that actually know their way around computers, like you said. It's not for the people that are used to using password managers. It's for the regular folks. And when you want to replace passwords with something more secure, like passkeys that are not limited by the length that you can memorize and don't have to write it down in the post-it note on your monitor, then the experience really isn't there yet.
It really isn't. The article brings up some concerning things that I haven't experienced, but the author provides screenshots and a walkthrough. Some in no particular order, some of the challenges. For example, PayPal not supporting Firefox on any platform. So if you have your passkey saved there, well, too bad. They also show a screenshot where it looks like an Apple Touch ID standard login prompt that you would get if you're just trying to authenticate virtually, anything on a Mac. You're probably trained to just hit the Touch ID button at this point. And the verbiage doesn't really tell you what's going on. It just says use Touch ID to sign in. It doesn't say anything about a passkey. It doesn't say anything about what's going to happen. But if you look at the smaller print, which, I'm looking at the screenshot right now, it looks like a 4-point font or something. It's telling you that it's going to be saved in the iCloud keychain. Now, those are just some examples. And for a more practical example, a theoretical example, for some people, this can start off as easy. You have someone who has an iPhone and they say, hey, the passkey thing, how do I do it? Then you tell them and show them and they start using it. And maybe they like it and it works great and they have no problems with it. But then later on, they switch to an Android phone. Now there's a different conversation starting, because now it's, how do I get my passkeys out of this one device? Am I going to lose my accounts? Is there another way to transfer this? Well, there is. Passwords, believe it or not. As the article mentions, these sites require a password still. And I think the idea is to wean people off of passwords to they have a passkey in parallel to a password. And I'm sure there's going to be examples of sites that do allow passkey only. But the article mentioned a series of websites that still require a password. So presumably you could just maybe unlock your account with a password, generate a new passkey depending on the website. But passwords, we're trying to get away from that. So here we are using a password. And then the article also mentions the fact that you can store your passkeys in your password manager, which is great, which is what I'm sure a lot of us do. And that works only to a point, but it's at a, I mean, it just seems like it's just not much different. You're managing passkeys, passwords, your password manager is logging you in at the end of the day, and you probably don't care how it does it when you're trying to get to a site in a hurry. And it just makes it harder to differentiate it. And meanwhile, we have an implementation that every vendor is trying to do their own thing. it's and we expect it to take off. And the article casts some serious doubt on that.
And the other aspect of this is that on the enterprise, you need to train your users to do this. You need to tell people how to use passkeys. You need to tell them that they can share this between their devices and it will be fine, and how to do it and get them to actually use it. There's already some resistance when you try to implement more complex passwords, because people will try to say that they can't memorize it, they can't change it as often, it's not impossible to do that, they'll never be able to come up with a good password, so they'll keep reusing it or something like that. If they're already struggling with the most basic form of authentication, anything else, regardless of what it is, that has just one extra step or one extra screen or anything that's slightly more complex. And again, you need to remember that we're not talking about the professionals in the field that are going to be using this. If you want a replacement for passwords, it's for everybody. So even the non-tech savvy people have to be able to use it. Any hurdles that you throw their way, it's going to make it more difficult for them to accept it. And that's always going to be the resistance that you need to overcome. It's from your own users, from the company internals, the CEO, if he's not too tech savvy. If he says that it's too complicated for him to use, then the process is dead and you can't migrate to passkeys. Making this more complex than it needs to be, just because somebody is using Android and another person is using iOS and somebody else is accessing it on a desktop, and you can't standardize even the instructions because you're going to get different screens on different OSs and even on different versions or different browsers, you're not helping the process. For a password, you get the password prompt and you type it in. For a passkey, I now need to press my finger against the screen, or I need to unlock my phone, or I need to have an authenticator to unlock the device, or I need to press and type a PIN number, or I'll just press here that says ignore this and log in with my usual password. That's what I'm going to do.
Right. Yeah. And you probably couldn't remove your password anyway, depending on the website. You probably still have that way to get in, just like we've talked about before when we talk about multi-factor authentication. It's just annoying when you see, you don't have your second factor and then it says try another way, right? It gives you the option to try another way to get into your account, which means, there's other options for threat actors to get into the account. And then here we have an implementation issue, and it's just really hard to sell this to anyone, because at first, it's kind of hard to explain. It's this thing that lives in your phone. Where? It's two different files. How are they linked? How does it know it's me? And things like that. It's just one of those things that's hard to explain. But at the same time, like you mentioned, it looks different on every platform. Like, it looks different on your phone. It looks different on your laptop. And meanwhile, username and password fields look the same. The website might look different, but the username and password field look the same, and it's what people are used to. They're used to seeing that. Even if someone is using a Mac for the very first time, they've never put their hands on one before, they see a username and password, they know exactly what to do. They need to put their fingers on the keyboard and start typing. But when it comes to a passkey, well, now I'm on a Mac. Oh, well, now what? How do I get all my passkeys from Windows Hello over to Mac? Well, now I got to figure that out and probably call a relative, which is going to be someone in our audience, most likely.
One of the solutions for that would be, okay, now I need to generate a new passkey. It's a process that I need to do just one time. So I'll generate a new passkey for my phone to access the same website as I was accessing on the desktop. And that's fine. It's a one-time process, it's not really that much of a problem, so I'll create a new one. But then you come to the problem where some websites will only support one pair, so you can only have one passkey there for one account. They don't support storing multiple passkeys for the same user. Again, the original idea behind Baidu and Authen, it's really good. Like the article says, this is a pretty elegant solution to the problem. The problem is the implementation by the different vendors out there. Apple, for example, the example in the screenshot that was on the article, it's actually egregious. When you want to use a physical key to authenticate, to store the passkeys, the prompt that Apple shows you right now, the macOS shows you right now, forces you into using their own KeySync to the cloud, Apple Keychain or whatever it's called. And it forces you to into that solution. You need to actually press three different buttons to get to using the actual physical key. That's a problem. It's hiding the perfect solution right there. Somebody was asking, okay, so what should FIDO do? It's not a question of what should FIDO do. The implementation is crappy. We need to push back against the implementation. It should be standardized. The solution is good. Just make it usable and make it be the same across all the different platforms. That's the solution.
I agree. I'm wondering, do you feel like in the spec, there's anything that could have or should have been done when it comes to implementation? Meaning to be in spec, you have to implement it in a, you know, universal method that's not vendor specific. Because sometimes I feel like, you know, we invent amazing things and amazing technologies. And I do love FIDO. It is amazing. Even though I'm, you know, talking down on it, it's great. It's an implementation. But when you offer something to the public, this great thing that you created, and then expect the tech companies to always do the right thing, we've seen vendor lock-in before. These companies, like you mentioned earlier, this isn't their first go-around with vendor lock-in, okay? They're seasoned veterans in this, and we're going to expect that they're going to do the right thing. Do you feel like it could have been part of the spec, or maybe it was and it was ignored?
I don't know. It should probably have been spelled out in very bold font in the docs that you need to not override the login prompt. You need to always use this format for accepting the passkey or selecting the user and the passkey pair that you want to use. You can't override the screens. You can't redirect your users to some other screen before reaching this one. This is what you show when the user is prompted for a passkey. This is what you need to show the user. It's always the same process. Don't make it fancy, don't make it look different, don't try to personalize it, don't try to make it flashy. Use this format on all platforms. This is how you get users to use your product and recognize the way that it's supposed to be used.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's almost like we need a 10 commandments of FIDO implementation. Thou shall not lock people in or something like that. But if they're not forced to, I mean, the tech companies are probably going to have a rebuttal like, well, why wouldn't they want to be, have everything on this device? Because we want our device to be everything to everyone. And that's what we're doing. That's literally what we're doing. And that's exactly how they're going to word it.
And that's exactly the problem right there.
Exactly.
They want something different than what the users want. I mean, have you ever met Microsoft? Have you ever used one of their products? Again, Apple replaced that with any other vendor. They want you locked into their environment because that's how they make money. It's when you use all of their products and you use all of their software and all of their solutions and don't go to the competition. If they make it easy for you to move, then why should you stay with an inferior product? You'll just go to the better one. This way you lock them in and you prevent them from moving. It's always about that.
And I was almost okay with the fact when this all started, you know, earlier when FIDO keys or passkeys are starting to make their rounds, where you had, at least when I looked at it, two options: A, proprietary; B, your own key or your own solution. And even though I didn't like that, the default, you know, the radio button default was on the proprietary one, as you would expect. But it wasn't that big of a deal for me right underneath it to just click the other thing. I almost feel like that was a little bit more reasonable, and that it just seems like the vendors are getting more and more aggressive with this. And if they continue, then it's just going to get even harder because, I mean, what's next? You have to go into settings on macOS and go into privacy and enable non-Apple passkeys, and nobody's ever going to think to do that. I mean, what's the culmination here? How far are they going to bury this? I don't think there's any end unless we have something that says, hey, look, you know, here's a new version of the FIDO spec and it'd be in compliance. You got to make it universal. I don't really know much about, you know, how the spec side of this works, but I'd have to think there has to be something, because, you know, if we're expecting vendors to not try to have vendor lock-in, I mean, we're just fooling ourselves, honestly, all of us. We can't think that way, because we know, we've seen what they do. They do it time and time again. And of course, you know, companies are, I mean, those tech companies, the trifecta you mentioned, they're going to keep doing what they do.
Cory Doctorow has a good word for this. It's enchantification. It applies to all aspects of IT right now. security measures like this, it's just another one. And again, they're going to keep doing it. They're going to get away for as long as you let them get away with it. We need to push back. There's not much more that we can do. We can't force them. They're large. They're big enough that you can't force them to do anything that they don't really want to do. If this is how they envision of implementing FIDO and implementing the dialogues and making sure that you stick with them, then this is how they're going to do it. It's a crappy decision for the users. The users need to be able to realize that they're being pushed in a direction that they really shouldn't be going in, and not just continue to buying the next... I mean, you see this every time there's a phone launch. The new iPhone gets millions of sales every single time, even though it's just exactly as the previous iPhone with the new paint job on top. And people keep buying it. And again, while that happens, there's not much you can do.
No, but the only thing I think we could do right now is discuss this, have an open discussion in the community. I want this, and another good reason why I wanted to do the episode on this is I wanted to get people talking. So obviously, you know, leave some comments down there underneath the video. Let us know what you think needs to be done here. But ultimately, what I'd love to see is have, you know, some of the smartest people get together and just really try to hash this out, work together as a community and push back. And, you know, if we don't do it, no one will. I mean, the relatives that we're helping navigate this technology, they're not going to protest against this stuff. Only we can do it because, you know, in our field, we understand the problems. We understand why vendor lock-in is bad. So, you know, we understand the issue. We just have to push back and discuss this. And I'm hoping that something will come out of this. And the reason why I feel that way is because I really love this technology. I like the technology a lot. Even, you know, keep in mind, most of my criticism is on the implementation. I'm not really criticizing FIDO keys themselves. I want to see it succeed. I really do.
As it's just being mentioned on the chat, and thank you for bringing that up. I was almost forgetting about it. Some websites will let you migrate your keys. Sorry, not websites. There are processes to migrate to different devices that rely on a different type of authentication, multi-factor authentication, specifically SMS authentication, which seems to be the default on many websites right now. You'll add your phone, they send you an SMS code, you validate that it's you, and right now that's one of the weakest forms of multi-factor that you can have. SIM swappers are on the rise. It's very easy to manipulate. The telecom networks have been breached multiple times, as we've discussed in previous episodes. Right now, sending an SMS to validate the user, it's probably one of the weakest things that you can do as a multi-factor authentication. Using that to validate that the new key that you're trying to register is actually yours basically defeats the purpose of using the FIDO key in the first place. So, if you have a website or if you have an application that relies on sending SMS to users to validate them, please choose something else. That's not really effective anymore.
Yeah, it's in banking institutions, especially a lot of them out there still kind of keep the old ways of, and I agree completely with that comment. SMS second factor just isn't. I mean, it's barely second factor. It's just a minor nuisance to someone, that, especially in a targeted attack, to navigate. And it's just incredible how some companies are still stuck in the Stone Ages. So I agree. You know, it'd be great if they were forced to move away from that. I think that should be banned, honestly.
Again, you're weakening FIDO. You're using second factors that are really not efficient enough to validate that it's you that's owning the key. I guess that's all for today's episode. Again, thank you very much to everybody who joined. As always, it was a pleasure. Be sure to click that like and subscribe if you liked it, and subscribe to Jay's channel. He deserves it. And he's almost hitting another milestone right there, so keep it up, Jay. Again, thanks everybody who joined. It was a pleasure, as always. Until the next one.
Appreciate it.